Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who is Rupert Murdoch really, and what role has he played in shaping the media landscape of the 21st century? It's been a rough couple of years for Murdoch, as scandals rocked his news corporation and finally forced a split into two separate entities, a move Murdoch had long resisted despite pressure from shareholders. But despite the personal and professional fallout and control of a vast personal fortune, the 82-year-old Murdoch has not taken a step toward retirement, choosing instead to continue at the helm of his entertainment and publishing concerns. David Folkenflik has covered the Murdoch saga closely as media correspondent for NPR, and he has a new book out called Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. He joins us today from the studios of NPR in New York City. David, welcome to Think.
Hey, Chris, thank you so much.
So there are people who admire Rupert Murdoch. There are people who despise Rupert Murdoch. But in either case, what are the challenges of telling the story of a figure that people assume they already understand?
Well, I think you put your finger right on it. In some ways, people may think they already know him. He's been both lionized and demonized as a conservative figure and giant among, his media competitors. Some would say his liberal media competitors. He has reshaped the landscape with news organizations that we may feel we know. And he also doesn't really want that degree of scrutiny. He's not a self-reflective guy himself. He doesn't do a lot of introspection. And he didn't want to talk to me, and he didn't want his family or his aides or executives to talk to me. In one case, a top aide to him called one of his most senior executives and had that person call off a long scheduled interview I was about to do. So, you know, it throws challenges in your way. And that said, you know, a reporter is not simply going to be confined by whether or not a very powerful public person wants to be written about. You got to figure out how do you tell the story as fully, as completely, and as fairly as is possible. And it just requires a little more initiative to get it done.
So the inevitable comparisons to William Randolph Hearst don't quite work for you. To your mind, he's more like an oil baron of the early 20th century.
Yeah, he's a guy who sort of saw the landscape that presented itself to him and said, well, I see opportunities others are missing, and I see opportunities that others are prevented from doing, and I'm going to do it anyway and find a way to make reality comport to my vision rather than my vision comport to reality. So, you know, he ended up providing people with a product they may not have even explicitly known they wanted, fueled by, the raw material of often people's lives and missteps. Figures both very public and very private were sort of the raw meat of his news empire and newspapers in particular. Kind of tied it together in a way that people found it to be indispensable and wondered how they hadn't had it in the first place. So here's a guy who really, I think, created markets for new forms of what he did rather than simply being the best at it in the way that Hearst was.
Murdoch is astonishingly, and I have to say almost touchingly, invested in the ongoing existence of newspapers. Tell us a little bit about his father's history in the industry and how that may have influenced him.
Sure. His father was a much older guy, Keith Murdoch, who was himself the son of a Scottish Presbyterian minister sent from the old country to Melbourne, the second largest city in Australia, to establish a congregation there and keep it going. And Keith Murdoch thought hard about entering the clergy himself and ended up becoming an apprentice reporter and rising quickly to be one of the most respected political journalists in Australia. He's also known for this moment, that was depicted in the movie Gallipoli about this ill-fated invasion created by British commanders and relying so heavily on these Australian forces who were exposed to incredible dangers. Keith Murdoch wrote about it as he learned about this during World War I. It was sent to Australian political leaders and then relayed along to the British political leaders as an example of ways in which Australian troops were being treated horribly and cavalierly by their British commanders. And it was an episode that, as it became public, helped solidify a sense of Australian identity in opposition to their British rulers as they emerged as an independent force. It turned out that the the correspondence by Keith Murdoch wasn't entirely accurate, but nonetheless made his name. He was knighted for his service. He rose to be the head executive of this very influential newspaper company in Melbourne. You know, he was a wealthy, prosperous person by any definition of the time. His partners, however, maneuvered him out of some of his holdings in some other newspapers. And when, at his death, when Murdoch was only 21 years old in the early 1950s, Murdoch returned from Oxford, where he was studying in England, to find that his father was only able to give him one tiny newspaper daily in Adelaide, a very small kind of backwater city on the southern coast. He was really resentful. He was resentful of these guys who he felt had cheated his father. He was resentful of the fact his father had not been treated more respectfully by the Australian establishment. They didn't stand up for him. And he was resentful of, sort of what he was going to start in life with. Even though, you know, you or I might think that's a significant holdings, much less than he felt he was entitled to. And he nursed this sense of grievance and also this sense of, I deserve to be playing on a larger stage, both for myself and in honor of my father, for decades. In fact, until basically the present day, and that led to his unceasing drive to figure out ways he could get into newspapers in other cities, undercut his rivals by price, compete with them by having news that was more vivid, perhaps more compelling and interesting. More about politics as sport. Celebrity is sport. Sport is sport. and giving people things both cultural and public that they needed to know about, but often in a way that they weren't being provided elsewhere.
This account you tell of Keith Murdoch becoming a sort of folk hero in Australia, that all happened before Rupert Murdoch was even born. But I wonder, was it told throughout, in the family throughout Murdoch's childhood as a sort of legend? Because it does sound a little bit like some of the tactics used by some of Murdoch's media holdings to pull in an audience that needed a common enemy.
Well, in terms of Keith Murdoch and things like Gallipoli, that was part of national lore. And so, he would hear from people what a great man, his father was. The Mel Gibson movie, Gallipoli, if you look at it, one of the chief financiers of the movie was the production company Rupert Murdoch set up to do that. So he was involved in helping to reignite interest in this seminal episode in Australian history and this defining episode in Keith Murdoch's history. It was a family lore and it was national lore. And the Murdochs, were known nationally, but he transcended Australia. He established the nation's only general interest daily newspaper, The Australian, in 1964 to take on matters of public interest. And it served as a template for his desire to play both high and low, to have these tabloids that reached this kind of populist right of center sensibility for working class and middle class readers, some of whom don't mind seeing these punches being thrown at the elites or the famous or the powerful or the wealthy, all of whom Rupert Murdoch felt looked down on him over the years, and he still feels that to this day. And he also liked having those prestigious papers so he could talk to those elites, the moneymakers, the corporate chieftains, the political deciders, the people who had to see their conversations about what they were doing play out on his pages. So when he went to Britain, he acquired the News of the World, now infamously, the News of the World, and then he went on to get the Sun, which he turned from a money-losing kind of hapless liberal paper into a populist conservative, the top seller in the UK, a quite successful paper with the Page Three girls who were topless and all the rest, and he also went and bought the Times of London, which has never made him a dollar and is probably the most prestigious papers in the UK, and the Sunday Times, its sister paper. And so, he wanted to make sure people at 10 Downing Street were reading it and people in the equivalent of Main Street were reading his papers. And he would have influence with the elites through the discussion he would host, and he would have influence with the elites because prime ministers or people who wanted to become prime minister were relying on those mass audiences of his tabloids. And he would switch the tabloids back and forth. He did this again in the UK, here in New York with the New York Post, and in Australia, from center-left politicians to very conservative politicians. And by switching back and forth and being not predictably just for the conservative party, even though he's a conservative guy himself, he made himself all the more influential.
Because nobody knew whose favor who would have his favor from one election to the next.
Well, it gave people who were centrist but of the Labor Party or of the Democratic Party, it gave those centrist candidates hope that they, you know, if they sought his favor, that he might support them. And it kept the conservative politicians on their toes, that they couldn't keep him take him for granted. So, you know, they did and even to this day do pay very close attention to how his papers treat him.
I did not expect the line on page 12 where you inform us that at Oxford, at least, Rupert Murdoch adopted temporarily radically leftist politics.
Well, you know, college is a good time to sort of play with how you feel about. You know, he always has kept this anti-authority, anti-elite, anti-establishment sensibility. He's nurtured this with a sense of grievance close to him. And he's done it out of all proportion to reality. I mean, here's a guy who, you know, when Tony Blair was preparing to run for prime minister in 1995, he didn't go across town to London to meet him in one of his very fancy townhouses. He flew across the world to a small island called Hayman's Island off the coast of Australia to address Rupert and Murdoch's fellow executives to show that he would be deferential. Gordon Brown, Blair's successor and partner and also Labor Party rival, flew to Idaho, to Sun Valley, to do the same thing in 1998, preparing for the day when he would want Murdoch's support. David Cameron, the Conservative Party leader, 2005, flies on Murdoch's son-in-law's private jet to Santorini, you know, the island off the coast of Greece, to meet with Murdoch on a yacht to basically show that they can break bread and show respect, even though Murdoch comes to London all the time. You could easily set up a scotch or a coffee meeting there. No, they want to show deference. So, you know, the elites have bent to him. You know, Michael Bloomberg, not only the mayor of New York, but a billionaire media mogul in his own right. You know, Murdoch and he will have conferences where they discuss publicly the need for immigration reform or certain kinds of pushes towards charter schools. And, you know, the idea that elites aren't meeting with him are ridiculous, and yet he still thinks behind closed doors the people that he cares about are getting the raw end of the deal.
How close are his politics to the official positions taken by his media holdings, including Fox News?
Well, if you look at the tabloids, I think that's closest. He was under under oath giving testimony in London about a year or so ago. And he said, well, anybody who really wants to know what I think, you know, can read The Sun, the daily tabloid there. And I think that holds for The New York Post, too, that there's a strong sense that you can get a reflection of what he thinks by reading those big tabloid papers. Fox News. You know, Roger Ailes would tell you there's no one point of view at Fox News. And certainly you can discern differences between, let's say, Sean Hannity, who, you know, a reliably conservative and partisan Republican, and Bill O'Reilly, who's right of center, but, you know, will occasionally zig a little bit or zag a little bit, was a little quicker to embrace the idea of gay rights, gay equality than other figures in conservative circles. But, you know, Fox News, certainly its sensibility is conservative. Its storylines, even in its news programming, are designed to appeal to cultural conservatives who think that the rest of the news media is targeting coastal elites or liberals, particularly urban folks who might live between Boston and Washington. Murdoch himself is not as resolutely conservative as that. Murdoch supports certain kinds of relaxing immigration laws. Murdoch himself is an immigrant. Mm-hmm. He's a nationalized
right.
American citizen, which he did in part because it was important for him to be able to have American citizenship to expand his television holdings, which otherwise would have been barred under law. But, you know, he sees across borders world in part because that's how he's lived his life for the past 45 years. You know, different than what you might find on Fox News. And yet Fox has such a strong sense of who it is and is so profitable. He lets it go a little bit more right of his inclinations.
David Folkenflik is with us. He is media correspondent for NPR and author of the new book Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. We'll resume the conversation after a couple of minutes. You're welcome to join us by emailing think@kera.org, sending a tweet to @ChrisBoydThink, or calling 1-800-933-5372.
funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Human Rights, Creative Writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR and author of the new book Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. David, to what extent has News Corp over the years been a family business?
It's been to an extraordinary extent. Murdoch has structured the company in such a way that he and his family control 40% of the voting stock. And that means that in collaboration with a Saudi prince named Al-Walid bin Talal, who owns about 77% of the voting shares, they can basically forestall or block any opposition to, any board director they want to nominate. Time and again, since the scandals of 2011, shareholders have brought up motions to strip, for example, or vote against James Murdoch and Lachlan Murdoch from continuing on the board. And a majority of non-Murdoch shareholders have voted to dump them. But, with the Murdoch shares, they can keep on. In any other company, a board would have forced a CEO to step down. Even a founding person, he could have retired to be non-executive chairman and not been CEO of News Corp, and he refused to do that. Now, he did split the company under some pressure from his own executives, his own family, and from shareholders, because they don't want the financial problems of the newspaper to infect the much more profitable entertainment and television side. So he split it as something he promised never to do. And he's no longer the CEO of the slimmed down newspaper-focused News Corp. That's being led by Robert Thompson, who'd previously been the top editor of the Wall Street Journal. But actually, that's the company he cares about more. Hmm. And so he's more active in that company than in 21st Century Fox, at least emotionally, which he's still titularly the CEO of. But he's always wanted one of his children to succeed him, his adult children, by his second wife, Lachlan Elizabeth, or James, the younger son. Lachlan, he gave a chance to and promoted him. It would seem that he was going to be the heir apparent in the late 90s, early 2000s. And Lachlan yet got, he had a complicated tenure. It was not perfectly successful financially, but also there was this incredible corporate infighting taking place involving Peter Chernin, who was the top executive beneath Rupert Murdoch, and Roger Ailes. Lachlan Murdoch felt that both Chernin and Ailes were trying to block him and to make his path much rockier. And he resented them, and he resented the fact that his father didn't stick up for him. And his father's feeling is, hey, you got to learn to swim in the deep end, and you've got to do it on your own. I'm not going to intervene. Lachlan felt upset by them, a bit betrayed by his father. He retreated to Australia, took some of his tens of millions, hundreds of millions, and invested it in his own holdings down there. James Murdoch thought this was his opportunity, and so he actually had good stewardship in Asia. He then was named to head things in the UK and Europe, and his prospects seem exceptionally bright, a pretty good broadcasting chairman. But things blew up when it turned out that he had, been there during some of these terribly problematic times where time and again prosecutors, the public, parliament were told things that proved not to be true by James's immediate underlings. And he was himself involved in paying off confidentially one of the hacking victims in such a way that not only was the issue kept out of court, not only was the amount of the payoff kept confidential, but the very fact of the incident altogether was kept secret. And, he's not been charged in any way, but members of parliament concluded that that was done in such a way to try to hide from authorities that such a hacking instance had occurred. So James looks tenuous. Elizabeth Murdoch has kept her distance after being held at arm's length by her father for many years. He tried to bring her closer into the fold. She decided amid the scandal not to join the corporate board. She's an executive there in that she's over her own production company, a smart production company called Shine, that her father had News Corp bought at what many analysts believe to be a significantly inflated price that netted her over $200 million. Mm. But you know, if you ask if this is a family affair, it is a publicly traded company based, you know, a few blocks from where I'm sitting right now in the heart of Midtown Manhattan. And yet it is, you know, it is not unreasonable to describe it as essentially family. It is family controlled. It operates as though it's family owned. I was told by Nell Minow, who's prominent in the field of sort of advising investors about good corporate governance. She said, we have given an F to News Corp in terms of corporate governance every year since its incorporation in the United States, and we only gave it that grade because there is no lower grade to give.
Do you open the book with a scene of Murdoch apologizing to the parents of Millie Dowler. This is this 13-year-old British girl who, as it turns out, was murdered and whose cell phone was tapped by employees of News of the World. Do you... Can you give us any perspective on whether you think he was genuinely sorry for what happened?
You know, this is an incredibly compelling moment in which there's a small group of people in a suite on a top floor of one of the most prestigious hotels in the heart of London, not far from Downing Street, where the Prime Minister lives, and not far from the Old Bailey, where some of Murdoch's former editors and executives are on trial, even as we speak. And Murdoch was there to apologize, as you say, to the parents and the sister of a girl who was abducted in 2002. She was the subject of both a national search and of national media crush of coverage. And it was not just that she was murdered, but that she was abducted, which made it such a story because there was a rush on to figure out what happened. People acting on behalf of News Corp repeatedly hacked into her voicemail messages and published information that they gained from that. Time and again, you know, they published information that led in some ways for the family and friends to believe there was some glimmer of hope. There was also the allegation at 2011 at that time that the people acting on behalf of the tabloid had erased messages because the mailbox was full and that this would then allow more messages to be left so that there was more information to get. All these many months later, police say that is a possible scenario, but that it's also possible that because of a shift in the software and storage system being used by the cell phone provider, that it was done inadvertently. And so it's not clear anymore what that was. But in that moment, it seemed clear that the tabloid had not only interfered with the investigation by intruding on private and messages illegally, but that it had altered the nature of it and altered the family's understanding of circumstances by doing that. Murdoch was there with his head in his hands just saying, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. He was not stirred to great eloquence or insight or poetry or anything. He just kept saying, I'm so sorry. The lawyer for the Dowlers, a guy named Mark Lewis, had just learned days earlier that he had actually been followed by investigators for the News of the World and for News Corp in hopes by – they thought they would be able to find out that he was having an affair with another lawyer. Hmm. There's no proof that he was. They also just wanted to find dirt on him and his family because they wanted to use it against him. So he turned to Murdoch and said sort of cryptically, I know you know about me, sir, but I know about – you too, and I know your family, and I know that your mother, Dame Elizabeth, who's considered sort of a patron saint of Australia until her death last year, he says, I know your mother would be ashamed of you. And Murdoch looked up and he said, my father, you know, my father would be ashamed of me. And he thought of his father, who he felt never got the recognition he was due, would be ashamed of this low point in Murdoch's career. And it's an interesting moment because you have Murdoch reacting as a son. He's there. He had, you know, he has children and grandchildren of his own. You know, some of his grandchildren about the same age as Millie Dowler was when she disappeared. Her remains found 6 months later. You know, there's a very human moment there. And Murdoch, you know, one of the things about him is he hasn't had to confront in person people who felt they were wronged by his coverage, particularly not people who were not people of stature and power to begin with. You know, ordinary people, you know, I believe the Dowlers, I think Bob Dowler worked in IT, and I think her mother worked for a school or a library. These were not people who had ever dealt with the media before and not people who would have had any cause to do so. Mm. And yet here they are with probably the most powerful person in the English-speaking media in the world. And he is abased in that moment. It's a very human moment. I think he from what I'm told, he was sincere in the moment. You know, he's a guy who can feel certain things in the moment and then kind of doesn't dwell. He just moves forward. It's not his style to kind of to wallow. So then he moved forward.
You have some really disturbing accounts in the book of employees of Murdoch's really going after media journalists who might provide coverage that looks negative about Murdoch or any of his holdings. Can you talk a little bit about the most egregious examples you found?
Sure. Well, look, his tabloids, you know, engage in brawling approach to journalism. So if people criticize the Murdochs or criticize various parts of the Murdoch empire, you can often find a shot fired across your bow in various tabloids. That's not uncommon. Michael Wolff wrote a biography of him that was released, I believe, in late 2008, early 2009. And one of the things they do is they say nothing about you to try to give you no more attention. But in this case, he had said some critical things of the editor of the New York Post as well after a deeply racially offensive cartoon appeared in the New Yorker, the New York Post about the stimulus package being proposed by President Obama at that time. And so Carl Allen sought and received permission to go after Michael Wolff. And one of the things they did was they did story after story about Wolff's they basically helped encourage stories in blogs locally about Wolff having an affair with a more junior employee at Vanity Fair magazine, which was true, you know, his own doing, I suppose. But they did that simply as retribution, and also covered a legal fight where he and his wife were trying to get his mother-in-law into an assisted care home, and they treated it as though they were evicting her from a rent-controlled apartment. But the most disturbing things that I found in some ways was that Fox News, which has always been the most aggressive PR shop I've ever dealt with in media. It's not personal. It's just – it's confrontational. It's prickly. It's it sees everything as a threat rather than an inquiry. And it sees its competitors as enemies rather than as rivals. But they did things that I hadn't heard of before. So they did this thing called sock puppeting where, you know, you have PR people take on aliases. In one case, 20 aliases. Another person had more than 100 aliases. They used they'd have PR person buy a wireless access thumb drive on a personal credit card so that it couldn't be linked to Fox News or News Corp. Another one of their PR people had to use a dial-up AOL technology in the broadband era because they thought that would be a harder way to trace an internet protocol address. So they do this stuff where they'd attack every negative or even neutral blog posting, no matter how large the site. They would do something where they'd go after every comment, no matter how deep in the comments, no matter how late at night, no matter how small the site. They would argue back and forth to try to make it appear as though there was an army of Fox fans. And there are a lot of Fox fans out there, but they were creating these ones. To rebut everything that was said about a Fox personality or show that wasn't positive. In two cases, though, I found a number of cases where they were combative. In two cases, it seemed to me particularly pungent. In one instance, Tim Orango, now a distinguished foreign correspondent for The New York Times, was covering media for them in 2008 when there was this pitched primary, as we all recall, between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. And CNN was seeing a nice bump in the ratings. So Orango said, I'll do a story on it. Fox says, don't do that story. It's not worth it. You know, CNN isn't worth the attention. He said, well, I'll do it. And so the person who's now the top PR executive at Fox News, then the number two person, says, don't do it. You have no idea what they're capable of. And Tim says, it told me that he said, okay, well, it's just a little rating story. I'm going to go do it now. And he did. And then he got a call from a gossip site called Jossip here in New York. It no longer exists. But he got a call saying, hey, we're about to post something on you. Give us a call. He didn't call. The posting takes place and it says, you know, was Tim Orango just treated for substance abuse? Only it's more specific about it. And then it talked about him. You know, was he an addict? Had he just come back? It was rumored he had. They talked about him doing very soft profiles of network executives in desperate hope for a TV job. And this was planted by a PR person simply for Fox, simply in retribution. Now, Tim Orango had just come back from substance abuse. He was mortified. He thought it would be the end of his career. And to the credit of his colleagues at The New York Times and the top editor, Bill Keller, they embraced him. They said, Bill Keller sent him an email saying, you know, keep your head up. Don't worry about this. We don't take this stuff seriously. Second case is some ways even worse. Matthew Flam, who covers the industry for Crain's Business New York, a trade publication here in New York, received an email when he was making the same kinds of inquiries about ratings. And he got an email from what appeared to be the Hotmail private account of a senior producer for the O'Reilly Factor, who over a course of several emails saying, look, they're not going to give you a comment, but you're absolutely right. They're flipping out over this. Bill O'Reilly is going to host all of our convention coverage for the two parties because they're so worried about the CNN's ratings. He couldn't get a second source, and he made a journalistic mistake, and a real one. He posted that online. He didn't do it in print, and his editor said, well, it's not good enough for print, but it's good enough for online. Turned out to be completely untrue. Within an hour and a half, a top PR executive at Fox was quoted by name, blasting him, saying, you know, this is absurdly untrue. It's wildly wrong. Anybody who believes this doesn't understand Fox News. I don't understand why anyone could possibly trust anything this reporter, Matthew Flam, could say in the future. What they did was they intentionally duped him. He calls the person up and he says, what happened to the producer? And the producer says, who are you? He says, well, you sent me this email. And she says, I don't know what you're talking about. He sends an email to the account. The account bounces back. Fox PR had set up the email. They had fed him false information. And then they denounced him. They wanted to damage his reputation and credibility for having the insolence to do a modest story about CNN having a nice season in the ratings.
Knowing that, David, are you walking around, or were you, while reporting this story, with like the journalistic equivalent of a bulletproof vest? Are you, you know, carrying a mirror out in front of you every time you take a step down the street? Or did you worry?
You know, look, I've had my battles with Fox in the past, and they've certainly done various things. They put me on a blacklist for a year and a half, saying that there was a policy that no one at Fox News could talk to me after one particularly embarrassing episode where I showed that Geraldo Rivera was 300 miles from where he claimed to be in Afghanistan praying over the dead bodies of American soldiers.
I remember that one.
So, you know, like, things happen. You're a big boy. You know, they so far I haven't heard of anything that they're doing, and I'm not – you know, I'm not worried about it. You go where the story takes you. I've tried very hard to provide a textured look at Fox and at News Corp. You know, the fact that at times they've shown willingness to play a brawling, bruising, vindictive style of a corporate approach to publicity, that's not my problem. That's their problem. You know, I'll also say that, you know, it's not personal. They don't take it personally. They just do what they do because they feel like it's as though they're waging a political campaign. I feel I can think of it in the same regard.
My guest is David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR. We're talking about his new book, Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. His new book is called Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. David, it seems that one of the things that makes Murdoch so hard to fully understand, to predict, is the fact that his holdings, you know, include very tabloidy stuff like the now defunct News of the World, things like the New York Post. And then there are papers like the Times of London and the Wall Street Journal. Talk about how he sort of views these in different ways and the amount of control that he has tried to exercise over editorial content.
Well, he sees his tabloids that are something much more responsive to his direct touch. I think he tends to have, although in the first days of the takeover of the Wall Street Journal, he, you know, was barreling in newsrooms and talking about headlines, and you would see splashier headlines and continue to in the journal than you would have in its very carefully measured approach in the years previous. You know, he doesn't think that it serves the brands of the more prestigious broadsheets, as they're called, the Wall Street Journal, the Times of London, to muck around too much with the coverage on a regular basis. The people on the prestige papers told me he might call once a week, several times a month. The people on tabloids said he'd often call once a day or every other day and say, you know, what do you got for me? You know, he's just always very interested in knowing what the latest gossip was. He's probably the biggest gossip in his own media empire. Hmm. You know, fantastically interested in knowing the latest stuff in all of these countries. And, you know, he'd gossip with socialites, with leading diplomats, government officials, corporate chieftains, whomever he could get information from when he'd see them at various places. And it was, you know, a form of currency for him and a form of entertainment as well. So his tabloids really reflect where he's coming from more politically and more in terms of the stories that interest him culturally. You know, there's belief that certain stories originate with him. I talked to former editor-in-chief of the New York Post, who also rose to be publisher there, and he told me that Murdoch would often call with a rumor and that they'd have to chase it to ground and try to find a way to put it in print in a way that was consistent with the facts. But, they didn't always pan out, these tips, but you wanted to make Rupert happy as often as you could.
It sounds like if he had to choose between being rich and being powerful, he would let the money go and choose powerful.
You know, I don't think that that's the choice that he sees in his mind. Hmm. I think he loves newspapers because he loves that connection that he thinks only he really gets between him and everyday newspaper readers and because of his father's legacy. But he also loves newspapers because when you have really big circulation papers, that gives you an extraordinary base of loyalty that politicians are desperate to tap into. So the newspapers give him standing with politicians in both parties, and because he swaps his papers from party to party, they feel like they have to be on their toes because he could take it away from you. You know, he supported Tony Blair and the centrist leaders of the Labor Party for three elections. When Gordon Brown came in, a somewhat more liberal figure, his adult children, and also his surrogate daughter and British CEO, Rebecca Brooks, talked him into supporting a sort of more modern and pragmatist face of conservatism, David Cameron. Well, if each party thinks they have a chance of winning him but also a chance of losing him, they're going to be very responsive. So his newspapers, although the big tabloids in Australia and in London have been moneymakers for him, you know, those revenues are going down. But in a sense, it doesn't matter. They're lost leaders for his influence. And his influence allows him to get relaxation or allow him to sort of not worry so much about regulation or bars for the concentration of media properties that he has. In London before the scandal, he had about 40% of national newspaper circulation, and that's in a country where it really is a national newspaper fight. In Australia, he has between 65 and 70% of national newspaper of major newspaper circulation, and you know, he has extraordinary TV holdings in both those countries, especially in the UK as well. So his footprint, you know, in terms of what his reach is for his audience is enormous. And the politicians pay attention to him because of the newspapers in particular. In those countries, you know, broadcasting is regulated in such a way that you don't have the same opinionated fare that you do in this country on cable. And then the broadcast feeds the money into the system that until this year has subsidized the newspapers. So it's almost as though they're all interconnected, the newspapers, the political influence, the broadcasting fortunes, and it just keeps going as though it's an interconnected Mobius strip. You know, they all fit together. The difference this year is in splitting the companies under pressure from both his children, who've never been as interested in the newspapers as he has been, from his own executives who are desperate to figure out a way to unlock the revenue of those entertainment properties that are so much more profitable, and the outside shareholders who wanted to would have been happy for him to burn his newspapers to a ground years ago. He split the companies. He's trying to figure out solutions for the newspaper-based slimmed down News Corp. And he's, you know, everybody's reveling in the great fortunes of 21st Century Fox, the new entertainment and TV enterprise.
I was really interested to read that although clearly Murdoch was unable to shield Rebecca Brooks from the trial that she's undergoing as we speak for the phone hacking and bribery scandals, they're still connected socially.
Well, you know, photographers, I think it was for the Daily Mail, a rival conservative tabloid paper in Great Britain, They published photographs showing her on a yacht with Lachlan Murdoch and his wife. And I think Rupert was there at the time as well, although not in the picture. But, you know, socializing with the Murdoch's family off Sydney Harbor. And there's been, you know, I've heard, I would say, beyond talk and not quite fact. But the established idea inside News Corp that if she for some reason were not to be convicted and not to have to serve time, he would find her another top job in Australia for News Corp Australia, that he would help her to land. She is somebody who won his favor and affection as an extremely hard-driving tabloid editor, something she was very well suited for, except that, you know, prosecutors are now in the process this week and last week of presenting very damning evidence in court that she was not only presided over an era in which there was a fair amount of illegality, but one of the driving forces behind it in authorizing, paying for it, coordinating it, and using it. You know, none of that at the moment seems to have affected his feelings for her. He not only said, you know, this is the one I want to protect. People ask what his priority was in July 2011. He comes out of a townhouse where he lives with her and they're walking to a meeting, you know, that they're going to have at a hotel nearby. And they say, what's your priority? And he points and says, this one. And he later said, look, I was just trying to express a kinship and affirmation for somebody I care about who's caught in a difficult situation. But he had instructed his lawyers time and again, when particularly his general counsel here in New York had said, we have to bring oversight of this issue back to New York and away from London. They've screwed it up. They seem to have given misleading information to authorities and to Parliament. We have to take charge of it. And he said, no, our responsibility is to protect Rebecca Brooks. The general counsel finally left the company because he couldn't get Murdoch to focus on the obligation he had to shareholders. Murdoch relied on other lawyers who were willing to try to construct these ultimately fruitless defenses for Rebecca Brooks. And once she was past saving, they were able to guide him back to the path of protecting a company which, after all, has so many shareholders and so many other people who have a stake in it beyond him and his family.
I want to make it entirely clear, David, that as a journalist myself, there is nothing about the behavior Rebecca Brooks and her staff are accused of with regard to those scandals that I condone or approve of. But for context, it's not Murdoch's holdings are not the only tabloids that have been accused of this sort of thing. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, first off, we should say that, you know, although a number of journalists and editors for Murdoch's tabloids have pleaded guilty to charges of bribery and charges of hacking, you know, certainly Rebecca Brooks does not accept any of that. She's rejected right. All the charges she currently faces, and you can't underscore that enough. She hasn't really put on a full affirmative defense yet at all. The second thing to say is you're right again that you know there are a few isolated accusations documented by police in which they assert that people for Trinity Mirror, one of a rival family of newspapers, and that I believe one was with the Express, a sort of a pure tabloid paper that's even more closer to what we think of as being like the National Enquirer, was involved in such things. But you haven't seen widespread allegations by prosecutors against these other media outlets in the same way that you have against the Murdoch papers. And, you know, the Murdoch papers, you know, he's always felt that he was rejected by the establishment. And yet, you know, he had such close ties with so many figures. Tony Blair, the godfather to one of his youngest children, you know, a three-time prime minister. You had major figures in both parties currying favor. You had people in the police department now being accused of having accepted bribes, a smallish number proportionately, but a significant enough number that these are people who are not going to help forward accusations against the Murdoch tabloids to their superiors, and superiors having very close and questionable relationships. It turned out that two of the top officials from Scotland Yard who resigned in the wake of the scandal, including the commissioner, accepted gifts, thousands of pounds worth of meals from various Murdoch executives and editors. The top police officer for the country, the head of Scotland Yard, resigned after acknowledging that he accepted spa treatments worth £13,000, I believe it was, from a resort owned by a friend of Rebecca Brooks. You know, a guy who had led one of the early and very contained and very narrowly drawn inquiries of hacking at the News of the World went on to become a columnist for the Times of London, owned by Mr. Murdoch. So there were all these ties where even law enforcement officials were not inclined to go aggressively against the Murdoch stables, where politicians had been eagerly currying favor on both major parties. So there was no external check to the Murdoch empire. And because he had such a concentration of circulation, it just makes the very nature of his holdings there different than some of his competitors.
Was anyone who has followed this story as closely as you have surprised that Murdoch did not hang it up after separating his company out into two arms?
Forgive me, that Murdoch did not step down?
Did anybody think, okay, surely now he will step down? Or is that just something he would not and will not ever do?
A more introspective person, which I think would constitute about 98% of the population, might think that a different CEO would be required, mm-hmm. a different leader would be required at this time to lead the company into a new future with a clean slate, and probably somebody without the last name Murdoch.
Right.
And they control enough voting shares that perhaps one of the kids, Elizabeth Murdoch, might in particular be a promising candidate to come in and rise up and lead that company down the line. But, you know, that it needed a fresh start. He said under oath, I am the best person. You know, he said both, I didn't know what was happening below me, and I'm the best person to clean house and make sure this never happens again. And, you know, people who I looked to who were investment analysts said, you know, at no other company really would you see that continue. Most boards would just fire their CEO and move on. But because of the structure of the company and because of the nature of the man, he's not self-reflective. He wants to move on. He thinks genuinely that his vigor and insight is necessary for the company's further fortunes. And let's not forget, you know, a more conventional corporate leader would have not been able to build, I believe, in the decades he's led News Corp and now 21st Century Fox, a single paper in Adelaide to be this transcontinental operation. You know, he has major holdings in six continents. You know, he operates, I think, in something like 54 countries. He has about 55,000 employees working for him at any given moment. And, you know, he's done this through instinct, often proven wrong, but so many times proven right. And reality has bent to his vision so often that investors, to be honest, have often given him a pass on some of the decisions he's made. He bought the Wall Street Journal for $5.5 billion, and within about a year and a half, he had to write off over half of the value of it. That said, it just vanished and went away. $2.8 billion just vanished off the books. He bought MySpace for $580 million. He then sold it after his executives had run it into the ground for about $35 million. Meanwhile, Facebook, which, you know, was about the same kind of venture as MySpace. There was no it wasn't foreordained that Facebook would rise and that MySpace would fall apart. Facebook has a market cap worth about $19 billion. So Murdoch's made some pretty bad miscalculations as well. And at the same time, investors say, well, that's the guy who's gotten them there. They may need a manager rather than a visionary at this point in the company's career, but at the age of 82, he still thinks he's the only one smart enough, vital enough, who has the right gut instincts that can lead it to success and good fortunes.
David Folkenflik is media correspondent for NPR and author of the new book Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. David, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Oh, thank you for this great conversation. I appreciate it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Christine McConnell prepares our podcast. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.